You're listening to another episode of Our Delaware Valley. I'm your host, Marcus Goldman. With me today are Michael Herskovitz, who is a Holocaust survivor, as well as Chuck Feldman, who is the president of HAMEC, the Holocaust Awareness Museum and Education Center here in Philadelphia. And they're here to talk about the Holocaust, as well as a little bit of history and what HAMEC does in Philadelphia. Gentlemen, thank you very much for stopping by to talk.
You're quite welcome.
Before we get started talking about HAMEC and the Holocaust, do you want to give a little background on yourselves, how you got involved with HAMEC and how HAMEC came to be?
Our founder, Yaakov Riz, was a survivor of a Soviet labor camp. He was in the Gulag for 5 years, and he left his home in Poland and tried to convince his family to go. They would not. He went into the Soviet Union. Eventually, he was arrested for being Jewish and was put into the Gulag, and he survived. And during that time, he made a promise to God that if he survived, he would tell the world, and especially young people, about the Holocaust. He did survive. He eventually made it to Israel, fought in Israel's War of Independence, met his wife-to-be Sheila. They got to America in 1953. Sheila was from Bensonhurst, New York, and he fulfilled his promise to God. He put what we believe to be the first Holocaust museum in America in his basement at Castor and Levick. And I had a business around the corner. We knew him. He was a neighborhood celebrity. I went to see the museum, and I personally got involved at that point and have been president for a long time.
And Michael, do you want to share your story as well, your background? You are from Czechoslovakia, a Holocaust survivor.
Yes. I was born in a village. The village itself was approximately between 45 and 50 families, and most of them were farmers. But we were only in a village, was approximately 50 families, like I said, in two Jewish families. One was me, the other was my uncle. But we had a little grocery store, like you all remember, United States, the corner grocery store. People used to send a kid with a note. Mom and Dad gave him the merchandise, and then they stopped him once a week or whatever and paid for it. Me as a child started to go to school. And you know what? I didn't know any difference being Jewish or not Jewish. I played with the kids outside, every one of them, just, and I went to school with all of them. Now, one day I seen a gentleman well-dressed walking through the unpaved street. So I did not pay attention, you know. For him, a well-dressed man, something must be not wrong, but he must be somebody. Later on, next day, two or three walked. You find out they were German SS. They moved into Czechoslovakia with what? Not even one bullet. And the way I heard afterwards, they said, let us go through, and once we go through, we just go through and we leave you here. But they did not. As they walked through, they settled, and we started with the German problem. So, as I went to school with the kids, regular kids, played every night with them, normal child life. Till one day in school, the teacher told me, Michael, after the kids leave, you stay here a little bit longer. Come in your back room, I want to talk to you. So what I told myself as a child, what did I do wrong? I come to school every day, I do my homework, all that. So as I walked into the back room, he said to me, Michael, I'm the teacher and all this. As of tomorrow, you cannot come to school anymore. I said, teacher, what did I do? Nothing, just because you are Jewish. So I went home, I told my parents. They weren't too happy to hear it, but they had no choice, so I didn't go to school. After I didn't go to school, they said, a Jewish kids, a Jewish man, gotta wear a yellow star on a hand. So I put a yellow star. But believe me, I didn't know what the yellow star means. So I walked out to the kids and talked to them. If they asked me what the yellow star is, I didn't know, because I'm Jewish, I have to wear it. So every day we still went out a little bit playing, which slowly, they didn't allow me to go play with the non-Jewish kids. So we just went on, lived inside. Mom took care of the store. Dad was a milk buyer. Which they bought the milk in container. He measured, and we took it to the City every morning. And the horse already knew where to stop. There was a 2-liter container. Dad took a 2-liter from the carriage because there was no cars. Carriage and horse. Took a 2-liters, put it down, and picked up the empty one. And that's the way he went every day. While he was in the city, he bought merchandise for the grocery store. And he was home by 9 o'clock. Mom took care of the grocery store. And we just went on not knowing anything. You know, you couldn't ask the parents because they didn't have an answer. So after a while, one early morning, which was early Saturday morning, I want you to know they walked in always in Jewish holiday to Jewish homes because they knew every Jew that lives in a home is home in Jewish holiday. So they walked in early, early in the morning, woke up mom, and they said to mom, wake up the kids, dress them, and whatever, we got to keep going on. All right, you can take, I guess, 30 kilos or whatever, I don't remember. So mom put everything. We didn't have no suitcases. We didn't have no briefcases. So mom took a pillowcase and packed it with clothes, and we walked out. And as she walked out, there was a farmer with a carriage. We went up on the carriage, and he drove us to a, behind a railroad station. There was a fenced piece of property and dropped us off there. There was that time they called it the ghetto. It was right next to a railroad station. So we just hang around. Nobody knew anything was going on. So we hang around. And after a while, the train, an empty train came by. And the train was like you usually carry merchandise, you know, the cows, the horses, metal train with two sliding doors, and they put us in. They didn't give us enough time to lay down, just to sit down. So they packed us in a train. Here came the train. They connected us off few trains to the long train, and here we go. We went a day and a night. Nobody in the train had idea where or what happened. Till we wind up to Auschwitz. From the Auschwitz, the train stopped. They opened the sliding doors and everybody out. But it wasn't so easy. While we came out, there were a lot of German soldiers, dogs, guns, machine guns. You heard guns shooting, dogs barking, and German soldiers howling. So we got out from the train. They separated us right there. Kids, parents, old folks, everybody went in a different row. So, and handicapped, you know, there were kids beginning group by group. And by the handicap of the line were the handicaps. Handicapped, any one of them, they seen, they're not capable to work. Started from a child all the way up to the old folks, they went to the last row on the right side, and they were there. So there where my parents wind up, and there where my younger brother, I had a 3 years brother, wind up, because every child that the mother carried and it was too young to work, the German soldier grabbed it from your hand and carried it over to the handicap. So we were there on the handicap, and then came that every one of us had to go through. Everybody had to go to a big concrete building. In the concrete building, there were many, many barbers, which came from Poland. They cut our hair. And before we went through like a shower, a walking shower, and then we went through the other building. They cut our hair everywhere, and we went through the other building. They were tables, like picnic tables, you know, the longer, shorter. And behind the tables, they looked at you, and they throw you a jacket. They throw you a pair of pants, the striped one, which everybody's seen it by now. We walked out to the big yard. As we walked out to a big yard, we had to put on the clothes. But you know, the clothes didn't fit you because they were the first time I seen even wooden shoes. Didn't fit you. So you look around, there's a lot of people in the yard. Look around, and if you see someone got the clothes that don't fit, so you are able to holler and go to exchange. But right there, my father was separated for me. Till then, I was holding my father's hand, but right there they separated us. I was about 7. They separated us. And then they gave us the clothes to put on. We put on. No hair. Nobody recognized each other. They said to us, if your clothes don't fit, because there is a yard and a lot of people walking around without knowing who he is. Like I said, no hair, you know, no clothes. He said, exchange it. And I seen a gentleman try to put the jacket on and he couldn't. So I walked up. I gave him mine. He gave me his. I put it on. And that's where they were going. Right there again, they separated us again. Older people to work, separate, younger kids to work. Now, when my mother came off from the train with a 3-year-old child, you know, my mother was strong, growing up in a farm, grocery store, food. So she didn't want to let the kid go. So they forced her to let the kid go. They took away the kid. There where I seen my younger brother last time. And they put the kid on the last row between the handicaps. So from there on, they walked us in to a big yard, which there was already Auschwitz, the ghetto. Fenced around yard, right? They were separated, A, B, C, D, with fencing, and ladies, young, middle-aged kids went separate, older, you know, whoever was able to work went separate, and as we walked in, between us was only fence, barbed wire fence. Now, you could see over the fence. And some people, see, there were the already the barracks. We already walked in the barracks. Overseen, you seen it. So a lot of them seen mom, sister, and everybody. So they walked over to the fence, and they grabbed the salt holland mom, or Rivke, or Chaya, whatever, and they grabbed the wire. They never moved again because you, everybody knows what 12 volt can do to you. This was 48 voltage in the wire. So we seen the guy just staying there and not moving. So after a while, nobody went over, and they walked us in. There where they walked us into the barracks. The barracks, I'm sure you've seen on pictures, and in Birkenau, there were 6 layers wooden floors, and they whistle-blowed. German soldiers came in, and we had to take one and jump up on a bed, one of the floors, and 6 in 6 in 6. In the middle was built, like supposed to be the heater, but 3 feet high. The German soldier was able to walk on the top. He's seen you on the top floor on a bed. So that's what it was. When the barracks filled up, the gates, there were no doors. There were 2 big gates closed up, and we just sit there and waited. I don't know for what or when. After a while, we were there overnight. Anything has happened, the whistle blowed. German soldiers walk in, and in Germany, up, 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 and we walked out. And you know, we stayed, they called at that time, Appell. Appell was like the soldiers staying, 5 in a week, 10 in a land. In between the soldiers, there was enough room that a German, I don't know who he was, doctor anyway, German soldier walked through and looked at your face. Anything he didn't like on you, just pointed with a finger. 4 or 5 German soldiers followed him, and they took the person out. They took him immediately to the handicap. So we went back on a bed. And at 7, you saw they were strong enough. I was anyway strong enough. Survived the camp, so I must have been strong enough. They were, we went back on a bed. And again, next afternoon, they gave us some soup. Stayed in line, went back to the barracks again. In the morning, the whistle blowed. We had to walk out. We had to walk to the gate. At the gate were trucks to jump up, and they took us to a farm. The farm was full of stone and rocks. You know how a farm looked at that time. And there was empty wheelbarrows turned upside down. They told us, as you would take a wheelbarrow and walk through the field. If you see a stone on a rock, put it in a wheelbarrow and push it up the hill. There was just like in the movies. On the top, you look down, you could see every one of them. So 2 German soldiers with 2 German shepherds were walking on the top, and they were looking down. And there were men and kids and everything with wheelbarrows picking the stone. And I was up there. And you know, Jewish language has some words they understand in German. The 2 German soldiers was conversating between them, and they walk, and they didn't have to go down to each one of them because they seen them. So one says to the other one, look at the old Jew. He's pushing the wheelbarrow too slow. believe it, his friend, without hesitation, pulled the gun and shot the gentleman. I seen it. Gentleman let the wheelbarrow go. Wheelbarrow turned over, and he was dead. So that's the way we went next day. So every day we went out to work some other places. Became stronger, and that's what happened. I was there for a while, I guess.
How many years were you there? Do you know?
In Auschwitz or in the entire concentration camp?
Auschwitz and the entire concentration camp.
Close to 2 years.
Do you remember being liberated by the Russians or the Americans?
I never knew politics, Russian, American, you know.
Do you remember when the troops came in, though?
For liberation.
Yes, yeah. For liberation.
I still got one of the liberators when I speak. Because, you know, I go to speak. Yeah. Schools, colleges, even jails and everything. It's my lovely wife. Is she here? My lovely wife.
She's right behind you. Yeah.
I went to school. I've been going, I don't know, I guess, 14, 15 years from schools to school and colleges. Like I said, we even went into a jail where they didn't let my wife go in. But my wife was a tough lady. She said to the guy, if I don't go in, he doesn't go in. So she came in, and the guy came in and said, oh, yeah, she's been tough from the first day on. And she came in, and I spoke. I've been in, I talk, you might know more than do, from colleges to schools. I don't even know how many. I've been keep going, and I guess this was, I don't know, the last one, but this was the hardest one. Because thank God I passed 90, so it's not easy to walk. We go with a wheelchair wherever I can. And the other hand, today my wife picks the school because schools are any more dangerous. So she want to know everything about the school before we go. And that's what I did till the 90th birthday. I never, honestly, many times, I never thought that I'm going to make it. And many times, I felt I'm in the other side. Closed my eyes and I felt, but I made it and I'm still here, right? And you know what? I got beautiful kids, I got a wonderful wife, and I do what I can.
Again with me are Michael Herskovitz, who is a Holocaust survivor from Czechoslovakia, as well as Chuck Feldman, who is the president of HAMAC. Do you want to give the website, phone number, and social media information out about HAMAC? And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the programs that you have and what you do.
Absolutely. If you are interested in contacting us because you want Mike or one of our other, and we have 20 survivors, our heroes, and some liberators to come to your school, you can contact us at HAMAC.org, HAMEC.org, or you can call our center at area code 215-464-4701.
Excellent. Thank you. And with HAMAC, you've got the museum. Let's talk about what you do. You have the Anne Frank Theater Project. You have a few other programs at your museum. So let's talk about what people see when they walk into your museum.
Well, our museum or our center is not large. We're located at Klein Life in Northeast Philadelphia. We have a number of amazing artifacts, almost all of them contributed or dealing with our own survivors. But our mission, Michael's mission, and the mission of our survivors is to go to as many schools as possible, to educate as many young people as possible. We have over, this is an amazing stat, but last year we did over 300 programs with our survivors. We reached over 37,000 young people. And now that we're able to Skype, we have done programs not only to the five-county area, but we have done programming through Skype throughout the entire country and to countries around the world. Quite simply, Marcus, what we do is we bring the message. And the message is that hatred, especially state-sponsored hatred, can lead to what happened to Michael and his family and to millions of others. And before we go into a school or a class, we make sure that the teachers have prepared the students with some education. Our organization has also been instrumental in helping to get Pennsylvania to have somewhat of a mandate for Holocaust education, but we are working with people who are working with other states. We feel it's absolutely important and imperative, especially today, that students learn about the Holocaust and genocide.
Sadly, we have a problem where somewhere like one-third of the people don't believe that the Holocaust ever happened, and that is absolutely despicable. So how do you change that kind of viewpoint?
I was asked many times, we have deniers, and I know we have a lot of deniers. Some of them really know it happened, but they want to belong to somewhere that is a denier. Yes. Kids asked me, how do you approach a denier? And I answered, you know what? I don't even talk to him. I can't even answer him, and I don't even talk to him. Because his mind is made up, whatever you do, and he's going to say no till he lives. So that's what we do with deniers. We ignore them.
And what we tell our students after presentations by Michael and others is that theirs is likely to be the last generation to have the opportunity to speak with and listen to Holocaust survivors based on the fact that the Holocaust occurred over 70 years ago, and that it will be their job when they go out into the world and when they meet, unfortunately, Holocaust deniers to say, you know, when I was in high school, when I was in college, I listened to Mike Herskovitz, and it absolutely happened.
Like I said, we do what we can. But I said to kids, I hope in your time there's going to be peace, because I know in my time there will not be peace. So it's your job to turn the world a little bit over, which is not easy, because hatred is outside more than ever was. And I don't know why. I don't know why two people just hate each other. Because of the color, because of the eyes,
people
can't figure it out why they hate each other. They just walk out together and they said, I hate them. Because hatred in the world is still on. And I tell the kids, they still happening that they lining up kids and mothers next to the wall. And they shoot them with no reason.
Yeah, I found something very interesting out about the Holocaust guards. When the Germans interviewed the guards, many of the guards had to have a certain level of psycho craziness. They weren't parents because their responsibility was to kill children. So they made sure that they didn't have any parents that were guards. They kind of basically pulled some of the worst people on the planet in Germany to be the guards because they knew that they wouldn't have the heart and that they knew they wouldn't have the conscience and that they would be able to kill willfully.
Most of them had to be volunteers. I'm talking about SS. A lot of them were volunteers. So for them, it was easy to pull the gun. I don't know. They just enjoyed. In my time, I seen they just enjoyed pull the gun and one more going. The other hand, they knew that we not supposed to go back home ever. So I believe they felt the sooner they get rid of us, the sooner they be able to go home, right? So for them, it's just like shooting a rabbit or whatever. It doesn't mean nothing.
The fact that they would put that kind of devalue on, or non-value on human life is absolutely despicable and deplorable. Do you see those types of parallels in world politics today that you saw 70 years ago?
Not really, because I do not get involved in politics. The opposite, I just turn it off.
Is turning it off after what you've been through hard for you to see, because you have the voice that can make a difference because you lived what really happened?
It's hard to turn it off. But the other hand, even if I talk to a lot of kids, doesn't mean anything. Cool, you watch and you can tell the kids pay attention. Some school you watch, there's some of them even sleeping. Some schools they went, because I talked to a school in Cranston, about 1,200 kids, right? They bring it from all over. If we go every year for 3 days. I go places for 2 days, 3 days, and some kids are coming after the speech. And they come and they talk to me, right? And some kids are really crying. And we had some kids said, I'm Jewish, and my parents and grandparents died in the Holocaust, right? So some of them are what they call observe, and they know, they understand. But some of them just don't care. So what? He was a Jew.
two quick anecdotes about Michael and programs that I was fortunate enough to facilitate for him. After one of the programs, we were leaving, and he had spoken to, again, about 1,000 students, and a young man came up to Michael, and the teacher and the people who had set it up were there. He almost looked like he was wobbling. He was almost drunk with emotion. He walked over to Michael, and he said, "You changed my life." And that is a statement that we hear from lots and lots and lots of young people after they get to hear some of our heroes. And, you know, Mike thanked him. And the young man walked away, and the teacher, who was in tears, turned to us and said, "I want you to understand something. That young man is the school jock. He's on the football team. He's on the basketball team. We obviously can't reach everybody. But the more students we get to reach, the more we get to change their lives." One other quick story. A teacher called me, I guess, a couple of years ago and said, "Chuck, I was walking down the hallway and one of our seniors came up and said to me, 'You remember when Mike Herskovitz came to our school and he talked about his experiences?'" I said, "Okay." And she said to me, "No, Chuck, you don't understand. We have our sophomores come and listen." This was 2 years later. This is the impact that our survivors have and continue to have and change lives. And that's why, quite honestly, we want to do as much of it as we can for as long as we can. And we need your audience's help to do that.
We had a lot of students come in and thank me, and you can see the tears in the eyes. And some of them said, "My grandfather was in the camp. This one was in the camp. This one." And some of them said, "I'm Jewish." All right. So some are really accepting it. Some really got it. But some of them don't care to do it. They are the deniers.
Mm-hmm. The denier subject has to be addressed, at least, because it's a problem. And we definitely have to talk about it, even if we know realistically maybe we can't change their mind and their ignorance and their hate's going to prevail in the end. At least I feel like we need to at least continue to bring it to their attention.
Because it's here and it's going to be here for a little while.
For those in your audience who want to have a good response to anybody, God forbid, who comes up to them and is a Holocaust denier, one of our other survivors, our heroes, Annalise Nussbaum, who is in Theresienstadt, said to me and to a class, "You know what? The German government gives reparations to Holocaust survivors. Why would any government give reparations to lots and lots of people if it never happened?" That, to me, is a great response. There are two kinds of deniers. There are the deniers who are the hate-filled people. There are the deniers who just say, "How could that have happened? They're innocent. How could that have happened?" Those are the people we need to reach.
On the response to that, as far as the reparations, the ultra-right-wing fascist conservative theory is, or conspiracy theory is that it's a Jewish media, Soros, something or another, and that's how they'll respond with it.
We can agree that there's an element of Holocaust deniers who can never be reached.
Absolutely.
Because of their philosophy, their misguided beliefs. Our mission is to reach the people who, unfortunately, as you pointed out, more and more young people have not heard about it. And they are the people who shrug their shoulders and say, "It's such an impossible story. How could it have happened?" They're not necessarily deniers, but they're people who don't understand that it really happened. And those are the people we're out to reach. We reach who we can reach.
Through the education system, they're not pushing history as part of the focus anymore. And everybody in this room knows that if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat the mistakes that you've made. That's been something that the Greeks and the Romans and the Chinese philosophers and the Egyptian philosophers and the Sumerian and Babylonian and Assyrian philosophers all said 5,000-6,000 years ago, yet we continue to repeat it.
You know what? I really don't believe that cannot happen again. Somehow I got a feeling the hate goes on more and more and more. Bone will not wind up being good. Plus to the Jews.
Do you feel like the world is a powder keg of hate and anger right now?
I wouldn't say this, but there is a lot of hate.
Can the hate be reversed?
I don't know. It's not easy. We got to keep talking and talking and talking. It's going to take years and years.
Do you think it can be achieved through peace, or do you think that to get the word of peace, at some point there's going to be violence. Because it feels like, from what I see, I follow politics pretty closely, and it seems like we're in a powder keg state right now with the hate and the tension and the anger and the divisiveness. And it feels like we're just like one event away from a massive explosion of horror.
You're right, the hate. I believe, but the love doesn't come closer. People don't love more each other than they used to. The opposite. You find sisters, brothers, fathers, sons hate each other anymore.
A lot of that hate's over money and things like that. You know that? I've seen families fall apart over wills.
You're right. Talk about money.
The hate issue, I think, is again very important, and the fact that we're not teaching history the way we are, and the fact that young people aren't aware of the fact that the Holocaust happened because our education system has changed so much and we don't focus on the history. But we need people like you to go out and spread the word. If you could share about, if you remember, like what happened when you were liberated and how you got to America.
When I was liberated, they sent me to Budapest first.
Did the soldiers send you to Budapest, and were they Russian?
No, I was in a hospital, Munich Hospital. After I got a little bit more strength, they were looking around, where can we send anyone closer to home? To mine, closer home was a rehab in Budapest. So they sent me to Budapest. And in Budapest, my uncle, with his wife and three kids, never came back home. Like I said, he had the restaurant in the village, right, which the employees used to go and have a beer, and I guess talking about juice or whatever they wanted, all right? So, you know, it is still going on, and I don't know where the love is. Can you see the love in the world?
In some areas, I can see it. Not as much as I'd like to.
Some areas. Because I don't see no love between countries, between smart people.
You're dealing with a lot of ego, and sadly, ego, money, lust, greed, and power have all become important in that area.
Power and money. But it's here.
Yes.
It's here. It's too hard to get rid of it. Because if someone have money, has ego, and want to do what he wants to do, don't want to listen to the neighbor, what he want to do.
You are
correct. If I want to put up a fence, I put up a fence because I got money. Everything is what I got money.
You got that.
They're
right.
Going from the top on down, money.
So you were in Budapest. Did you go back to your village in the Czechoslovakia after that?
Yeah, my uncle came back home alone. No kid. He picked me up and he took me back to my village where I was. So our home was given away to a lady, and she didn't even let us in come to the yard. This is my home. I got it. They gave it to me, paid for it. My uncle's home was totally demolished because the German soldier used it for an office. So from there on, I went to Israel, because Israel announced anybody over 16 can come. And when I went to Israel, I went to the war. So I was in the war, independence war, for two and a half years, then in Sinai war, then in Israel. I worked hard. And I'm going to tell you what I say to kids. I worked very hard in my life to grow up. No dad, no mom, nobody to lead me. Worked very hard, but I never regretted, and I loved it. And from there, Czechoslovakia, I wanted to go to Canada because I had a brother survived.
Your brother survived?
Yeah, and he was in Canada. So communicated, but he couldn't get me a visa. Canada didn't want nobody in. So I had a sister in Overbrook Park in Philadelphia. She sent me papers, and again, I was with her for a while. And then, honestly, I hate to say it, I became independent. I was just about independent all my life. But I worked hard, and I said to kids, I worked hard. Life was not easy, but I appreciated it, and I didn't mind. I loved it. And I said to kids, you know, if you want to exist, you got to work. Hard work will never hurt you as long you like what you're doing. And that's what I all my life, till the last minute while I was in business. The business is still going on.
What business?
Automobile business. And my son is there, and thank God he's on a good place, making money, and the family is very... I got nice kids, I got the greatest wife, and I reached a past over 90, which I never thought I will. because the people telling me, doctors telling me, I was fourth time in life at the gate. But I said to people, I looked in, didn't like it. I closed the gate and came back and continued going on.
That's awesome. That is awesome. One last question. Since you've been to America, have you seen, because I've read stories of people seeing people that were guards at their camps and things like that. Have you had any of those experiences where you've seen Nazis in America that escaped?
No, but I've seen anti-Semitism.
Point.
It's here that what I've seen, but otherwise, no. And I tell you, I don't get involved with them at all. If I see some hate, I just turn away and go different direction. Because I call them, they're not smart enough. Hate, I said to kids, hate could hurt. Hate will hurt. And hate gonna aggravate you and bother you. So, and you can't teach them love if they don't have it.
That's
true. You gotta have the love. And you know, anymore, I hate to see parents and kids, sisters, brothers, they don't get along anymore.
I know. It's sad. Again, with me are Michael Herskovitz, who is a Holocaust survivor from Czechoslovakia, as well as Chuck Feldman, the president of HAMIC, the Holocaust Awareness Museum and Education Center here in Philadelphia. Do you want to give out the website, the social media information as well, the phone number?
Sure, absolutely. You can reach us at info@hamec.org, HAMEC.org, if you want to email us, or you can go to our website at hamec.org, and you can contact our center by calling 215-464-4701. And what we're interested in doing is having Michael and others of our heroes provide programs at schools that you are involved with or that your children go to. And we want to do as much as we can to provide Holocaust and genocide education, which unfortunately is sorely lacking.
I got to mention, I guess Chuck knows, that my wife is involved very deeply in the Holocaust situation, and even in the museum, she's involved. And she's a tough lady. She don't take no crap from nobody.
Outstanding. That's going to be our closing line. She don't take no crap from nobody. We're going to close with that one. That is great.
She's a wonderful lady, tough lady, and don't take nothing from nobody.
Before we wrap it up, I just want to say thank you for sharing your story. I think it's important that people hear these stories, especially in the world we're living in today, where we're hanging on a balance, I guess would be the best way. It's a very thin line of balance right now, and we've got to be careful to which way we tip. And so hearing your story and hearing stories like yours, I think will make a difference. Are there any parting words of advice you could give before we wrap it up, Michael?
My advice is just study and believe and love. No hate. Hate gonna hurt you.
And any final words from you, Chuck, before we wrap it up?
Just a big thank you to you and to your audience. And please take advantage of our museum, our education center. Call us. We want to do as many programs, and Michael wants to do as many programs as we can for as long as we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Chuck, thank you very much for your time. That concludes another episode of Our Delaware Valley. I'm your host, Marcus Goldman. If you would like more information about Holocaust Awareness, HAMEC, or anything Our Delaware Valley related, all you got to do is email me, marcus.goldman@bbgi.com. We thank you so much for listening, and we invite you to tune in next week to a brand new episode of Our Delaware Valley. Have a wonderful Sunday.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.